Hello and welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And we're back in the outdoor studio.
Yes.
And we have a street sweeper.
Street sweeper.
It is autumn. In fact, I'm going to wait.
Yeah, I think that's wise.
Here we are, and this week we are doing a special episode to give you some isolation reading recommendations for our shelf isolation, as we say, or quarantine reading. But first, some book news. And so in lockdown news, the Booker International Prize has postponed its announcement. I think it was going to announce the winner, was it, on the 19th of May, because we have the shortlist to a later date, which they haven't announced what the date will be. And they're allowing for the, I think, delays in supply at the moment because readers are not able to access all of the books.
Oh, okay.
And I think that it's to give those books on the shortlist
time
to get their sales boost and to give readers a chance to read them, you know, to be invested in
that's a really practical way of looking at it. And I think often, awards tend to focus on just the prize money or the prestige, but it really is such a good booster for books that may not have even been in the market,
you know,
especially with something like the Man Booker International, where they might have been published in the UK or the US and maybe not released in Australia until they get on that shortlist or long list.
That's right.
And so, that's great.
And the Women's Prize also would normally announce the winner in June, and we talked about the shortlist last week, and I think that's now September again. Possibly for a similar reason, but I think also they want to have the party.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah.
So that, which they can't do at the moment. So that's interesting. And I also read, I think last night, that book sales have gone up on the whole, but Annie might have more about this at a local level in Adelaide. But in, I think Waterstone said its online orders had gone up by 400% in 1 week. I don't think that's across the board. But then the in-store sales obviously are much trickier.
Yeah.
But
well, it sounds as if Waterstones have closed, haven't they?
Yeah, so they were a slight delay in closing, which was a bit difficult for their staff, but they have now closed. So obviously it's all online for them, and they're well set up already with online sales.
Absolutely.
So that's easy in that regard. Mm. But it is trickier to buy in-store. But Annie, how have you found it at Mostly Books?
Yeah, look, it's been interesting. I think we've seen a shift in what people are buying. Definitely a lot more educational stuff for people who've got kids at home and are trying to keep them either entertained or educated or both.
Or
maybe
just quiet.
Or just quiet, yes. A lot of people seem to be buying those kind of have always been sitting on the TBR list classic type reads. So, you know, we've sold some War and Pieces and really chunky classics that I think people have had on their list of I've got to read that in my lifetime. And it's like, well, if I don't
Now's
read it now, when am I ever going to read it?
Yeah.
So that's been good. And yeah, we've been selling a lot more just kind of nice fiction, easy reading or, you know, entertaining books rather than the big serious heavy ones. But you know, with Jess Hills just having won the Stella Prize, we've sold a fair few of that this week.
Good.
And I think people are saying, you know, I think people have got time to indulge their interests a little bit more, and so we're selling a lot of kind of cooking books and crafting books and sourdough making books.
Yes, there's a lot of baking going on. And I guess even for people who are working, like, this isn't necessarily an easy just relax and read sort of time during the day, but even in the evenings, because you can't go out, I think that's
exactly
a time
people
that you
have
might
a lot more at home
might
time.
Be,
and
yeah.
I guess trying to find activities that you can do about the house relatively inexpensively and perhaps with the whole family. Yeah, so it's
good.
It's been good. We've been doing lots of deliveries to people's doors and
very good.
Doing some isolation drop-offs.
Yeah.
So that's been really lovely. I've enlisted my mum and she's
good.
Been going about.
new,
she's thrilled to get out of the house.
So you've got a new staff member.
Yes.
I love
it. She's not on the books. Doing it out of the love of her heart.
Oh, that's good. So we've got some isolation reading recommendations this week on that note. And I think Annie's going to go first.
Yes.
We've got about three each. We've tried to limit ourselves to three each. So
it's you know, I could go for days. But okay, so I'll start with my nonfiction selection, which is very appropriately The Lonely City by Olivia Lang. So we read one of her, well, her first fiction book on the podcast last year, Crudo.
Yeah.
But I've also read, she's got three nonfiction titles that I've read and loved them all. She writes this really interesting blend of memoir and cultural criticism, history, and yeah. So this one is about, she moves to New York following a man and gets there and they immediately split up. And so she's from London in a new city with no friends and no relationship and kind of becomes a little bit depressed, obviously. And New York is the kind of city where, I mean, I've never lived in New York, but I've been there and I've lived in big cities like that. And I can imagine that you would feel very cut off from the world if you didn't have contacts and didn't have a routine or a life set up there. So her way of dealing with this loneliness is by researching other artists who have had that same experience in New York. So yeah. She devotes a chapter or so each to about six or seven artists who made work and lived in New York City and kind of either explored loneliness in their work and or were lonely in their personal lives. So we get Andy Warhol, we get an artist who was largely unknown in his lifetime but who created the most incredible collages in his room, which perhaps have a slightly creepy, perverted, childlike nature to them, but these huge cherubic collages. Yeah, so I really love the way she blends her personal story with a look at all the different facets of loneliness and how physical loneliness can be, I think, and the way that these artists have tried to react to that. And Edward Hopper is another one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and there are some pictures in the book, but it's the kind of book that you want to just have Google at your fingertips at the same time and kind of look in to discover works from artists that you might already know but also works from artists that you don't know. And it was a really incredible read.
Loved Crudo. And I also then read A Trip to Echo Spring, which was nonfiction by Olivia Lang, and that was following six writers and their alcoholism and how destructive that was. But I love it because, as you say, it's the blend of memoir. So you get a lovely personal narrative, but then with lots of really stimulating, erudite references to, you know, artists or writers or facts or things.
But I don't think it's ever kind of out of the reach. I mean, you don't have to know art to read this book and enjoy it. I think she is a really approachable writer and her tone is always so warm and slightly wry. You know, even when she is at her lowest point, I think because she's writing it after the fact, but she's doing the research at the time, you know, you get this really interesting mix of feeling but also thought, you know, that she's trying to think her way out of this problem, which is very much how I deal with my problems.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I really love it.
And it sounds very apt for these times, slight isolation theme. Well, I'll start then with my nonfiction. So that was The Lonely City by Olivia Lang, which is really high up on my TBR. And my nonfiction book is A Month in Siena by Hisham Mattar. And it's a shorter book. It's only about 115 pages. And Hisham Mattar was born in New York City to Libyan parents. And he then spent his childhood in Tripoli and then in Cairo. And I think he's based in London now. And he wrote the book called The Return. Sorry, he's written a fiction book as well. His novel In the Country of Men was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, as it
I hadn't put that together.
No, and I haven't read that, but I read his nonfiction book, a bit like a memoir, called The Return, which was about his father disappeared or was taken when Hisham Mattar was young. And since then, Hisham has not been back to Libya, but he goes back, I think he's in his 30s when he goes back. And he really has to come to terms with the fact that they won't find or they haven't found his father and he's presumed dead. And so that is a very powerful memoir and beautifully written, and I remembered enjoying that. And then I saw in the bookshop that he has this very slim book that I didn't know he had coming out called A Month in Siena. And so I bought it partly because I love Hisham Mattar, partly because it has a beautiful cover. Yeah. It's just a lovely, lovely object, very elegant object. Mm. And also because I've been to Siena briefly many years ago and loved it. So my memory of being in Siena was, you know, take me back. And so I thought, why not go with Hisham Mattar? Yep. And it is so beautiful. It's a really, really lovely read. So the premise is he has always loved the Sienese school of art, which I didn't really know anything about, but it's artists from the 13th or 14th centuries. I'm going to have that slightly wrong, but he's liked that art since he was young. He finished writing The Return and then he decided he did need to have a break, as you would. And so he goes to, and he had never been to Siena. Yeah. And so it became, he said it's almost like a pilgrimage because for him that's almost like his religion. And so he then goes, and he goes with his wife, but she sort of leaves him there, and then she goes back to, I think, America or back to London. And so he's there for 1 month and it's just him it's just lovely.
Is it
just
kind of in a diary style, or is it?
It's not a diary style. It's just a sort of a memoir style, but it's him telling you a bit about the art and why he loves it. And he'll focus on a couple of different artworks, and there are beautiful coloured pictures so you can actually see it. So that makes it easy for people like me who, I'm not immediately familiar with it when he says the title. But it also just talks about his day-to-day. Yeah. So he meets a man who is from Jordan, and so they speak Arabic together, and the man immediately invites Hisham Mattar to dinner because they're so welcoming. And he goes up and he buys a couple of children's books for the man's children and a basket of figs, and I just thought that's so elegant. You know, he's just goes there for dinner, and so you have these little interludes, and then the next morning he'll go and visit, and he paces himself as to when he will go and look at an artwork. He doesn't just do it all in one day. He's sort of very deliberate about it. And so the next day he might go to a gallery and stand in front of one of the artworks, he gets to know some of the guards, or
it
he
is
feels
almost
like
kind of religious asceticism, you know, that you're really eking out that experience of that if you go too hard, too fast, it'll be overwhelming for you, and you know that.
That's right. Beautiful. And he talks about how normally he feels, other than every so often, he feels out of time, in the sense that he's aware of some other time happening or something else that he's meant to be doing. And he said the whole time he's in Siena, he always feels in time.
Wow.
And that's exactly where he's meant
to be.
And it's this just beautiful. So in that sense, the whole tone of the book and his really lovely, erudite, intelligent personality is hugely calming and comforting.
Yeah, and I guess just a reminder to stay in the present and to do what you need to be doing, and that you can't do anything else at that time.
That's right, that's beautiful. To stop and look at things and give yourself time to think about them. But it is also an escape to Siena. It's stimulating. You're learning about this school of art and it gets you interested in it, but it's very gently done. And so
I might have to swap that one.
Oh, it was so beautiful. So I really recommend that. What's your next one, Annie?
Okay, so on to fiction. So a book that I picked up at the op shop years and years ago because it has the most beautiful cover is A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. And I've now read all of her books because I love her writing. She is funny and intelligent and emotional. She's very
astute.
Yes, emotionally astute. And this one is about a Canadian writer who is living in the kind of far north of Canada with her partner. He's a scientist and is working on something obscure up there, and she is experiencing writer's block, and she's in this totally cold, totally desolate place. And what she does every day is goes for a walk along this freezing cold coastline. And one day a lunchbox, a very kind of Japanese iconography lunchbox, washes up, and inside are the diaries of a young girl from Japan who has decided that she does not enjoy her life anymore and is going to commit suicide. And so the writer begins reading these diaries and becomes immediately attached to the girl, and you too, because you want to know what becomes of her, how did her diaries end up in the sea? You know, did she end up committing suicide? why is she so miserable? And so it's just a really beautiful human story about the writer's developing obsession with this girl. She ends up trying to track her down. And the girl's story in Japan as she feels alienated from everyone and bullied at school and all of these different things. And it's transportative in several different ways. It then becomes the kind of Japanese story that I really like, where there's some metaphysical elements to it, you know, are there ghosts or is it this girl's imaginings? And yeah, I just love it. And it's just such a sparkling and wry tone to it that I think it totally takes you out of whatever funk you're in.
Yes. Well, that's what we need, isn't it? Well, that you've sold me on that one too, Annie. So I have heard this recommended before. Mm. I think on the, you know, the Get Booked podcast that Book Riot does, mm-hmm. where people write in with questions, you know, I want a book that reminds me of this, or I'm going to Japan and I want whatever it is, and they give recommendations, and I'm sure that they've mentioned this more than once. Mm. That's come up, so it's been on my radar. Yeah. Good. So that's a tale for the time being.
Yes, indeed.
So my first fiction is The Summer Book by Tove Jansson, translated by Thomas Teal, and my edition, and this is the one I recommend you get, has a foreword by Esther Freud, and Esther Freud basically explains so much better than I can why this book is so good, and also I would say so perfect for the, you know, moment, as a comfort read at the moment, but not comfort read as in wishy-washy, warm and fuzzy, because Tove Jansson is quite matter-of-fact and unsentimental with her tone. But Esther Freud says, "The Summer Book is impossible to categorise, a work of fiction, adventure, humour and philosophy. Its structure, a beautifully observed overlapping of the months of summer. It is a life-affirming story of every flower and delicate moss that manages to survive on a remote island in the Gulf of Finland, and of the understated love between an old woman and her grandchild." Oh. Yeah, it's really, really special.
Because she wrote for children, but this is not a children's book.
So Tove Jansson wrote the Moomin stories, which I loved growing up, and they have that same tone of really like a great adventure and fabulous characters and very warm, but it's also matter of fact, like they're very blunt, you know, and that must be the Finnish humour. And I find that so refreshing. Mm. So, and it's also very comforting. So this is about Sophie and her grandmother, and Sophie goes to stay with her grandmother on this island it is remote in Finland, and they just hang out. Mm. And so there's not a huge plot, but her grandmother's obviously aging and reflecting on death. And Sophie will say things to her like, "Are you going to die, Grandma?" And her grandmother will say, "Yes. But, and you know, when? How, when are you going to die?" And she'll say, "Well, that's no concern of yours." You know, like it's just lovely. Yeah. It's really lovely. But there is weight to it as well. It's not just a light, not a flimsy book.
Yeah.
And whilst there are moments like that feel whimsical, it's not a light
twee book either.
It's not twee. Yeah. That's right. That's the word. Yeah. And so her grandma, and there's a lot about nature, which I think is, again, a very something that people are turning to at the moment. Mm. And that's part of that culture, I think, as well. And Tove Jansson loved art. She was a sculptor as well as an author, and she drew. And so there's that, and she loved nature and being in nature. Mm. So the grandmother cultivates this magic forest, which of course Sophie loves. And they really inspect the small insects and the moss and the plants, but it's not done in none of that is as boring as, you know, you might worry about if you're not, because I'm not much of a plant, although I've been converted by the overstory. I'm obsessed now, but when I read it, I wasn't, you know, at all fussed about trees and plants. But it just infuses it with that, it grounds you, I think. And so their relationship is lovely. But as Esther Freud said, it's hard to categorise and express why this is so rich, but also so,
joyful.
So joyful.
Like,
yeah, it is.
Also, have you read her really companion book? Because there's, I think, the winter book as
I've
well.
I've got the winter book on my shelf. And so I chose the summer book. I haven't read the winter book yet, but I chose the summer book, and that's been on other lists that I've seen for this time. And just as an alternative, I'll mention, but we won't have time to talk about, if you like that dynamic of the grandparents and the child, There Was Still Love by Favell Parrott. Mm. I think that's also a really lovely, comforting read. So, Annie, what's your next one?
Okay, so my final one is by an author who every book of his that I've read, I always come out feeling just at peace at the with the world and really gentle. So it's Colm Tóibín, who's an Irish author, and this one is Nora Webster. I could have chosen any of his books that I've read.
I love him.
I love his writing. It's just so soft and accepting, I think, of everyone's condition. I don't think he shies away from the hard things in humanity, but he doesn't judge, I think, as well. Yeah. And so this one is about a woman in her 60s, set in the 60s in Ireland as well, and she loses her husband, and he has been the person, the much stronger personality in their relationship for their whole life. And so she now finds herself totally bereft and at loss as to who she is. And so it's a book about her gradual re-entry into the world. He was very political. She's not. He was loud and rambunctious and boisterous and musical, and she's not. But she joins a choir and she comes back to the world and finds herself again. And I just absolutely love the softness and warmness, and yeah, it's like a big hug.
Oh, his wonderful. Books. Well, you've sold me on that one. I love Colm Tóibín. I've read Brooklyn.
Yes.
And then I read his homage to Barcelona, which was really good as well. Yeah. That's a non-fiction. So, yes, sold on Nora Webster. And my last fiction read is Till by Daniel Kelman, translated by Ross Benjamin. And this is a recent release. I loved Daniel Kelman's Measuring the World. Mm. And this is his latest novel, which has been shortlisted for the Booker International. And I chose this because I think the other thing that had a sort of small books I think are good at the moment, and Tove Jansson, any of her work, Colm Tóibín, with that comforting but still dry style. But sometimes also what you want is to escape into a sweeping adventure, and this fits that bill. And there are a number that we could have picked for that. Mm. And perhaps that's a bit like A Tale for the Time Being is a bigger adventure story. But this is really fabulous, very rich, very imaginative, and it's about Till, or the title character is Till, who was a prankster in German folklore who I hadn't been familiar with, but that's not saying anything, but you would be if you have studied German, sort of the fabulist tradition. And so Till was also sort of acrobatic and a joker and juggled and got by on his wits. And what Daniel Kelman has done is really made him into a character. So he gives you his childhood and how he got to be there, and his father was done for witchcraft. So this is going back to, I think he sets it in the 1600s. So there are witchcraft trials going on. And so it's very, you know, Till has to really survive in the woods on his own. And that's how, and then he develops these skills and becomes this character. But then he appears in the lives of these figures from history. Yeah. And it's set in the 30 Years' War. So that's the backdrop. And he gives you Elizabeth Stuart, who comes from England to marry a German prince. I've forgotten his name, but that's okay. And in one of the scenes, she's thinking back to her time in England, and she's sitting there receiving visitors with her father, who I think was the king at the time, and Shakespeare appears and she talks to him about his son, Hamnet.
Oh, wow.
And so that is just
another little
6 degrees
there.
Of separation with Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, which I'm dying to read. So you get all these snippets, and there are other characters who are real characters from history that I didn't recognise their names. And you could then, if you wanted to, you could really do a deep dive into lots of these interesting people. And there's a lot about religion and the 30 Years' War. But it's really how they interact with Till as well, and there's a lot of humour to it. So he really undercuts the, you know, the pompousness of some of the royalty figures, for example. So it's fun, it's rich, it's original, and it will take you to a completely different time and place.
Wow.
So
that it does gives sound you attractive.
Yeah, it gives you all the escapism. Yeah. But if you're wanting something that will really sweep you away, you know, for a longer read, it's not too long. It's about 330 pages. So it's not you know, it's very doable, but I highly recommend that. That's Till by Daniel Kelman, translated by Ross Benjamin. Mm. So there we are, Annie. Right. That's a lot. And there were so many more we could have mentioned. So
tell us what you're reading.
Let us know what you're reading. And if you want us to do more, the other whole category that I haven't mentioned that I think people are escaping to is crime.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think I'll do a separate list of I might do, you know, we could do up to 10 mm-hmm. crime, our top crime for the moment. Yeah,
very
I think.
Easy.
So that's easy to do. And I haven't mentioned any crime novels, but I think they're always a fun escape. And Ruth Ware, who I spoke to the other week about The Turn of the Key, said she was turning back to classic crime herself as well.
I mean, Agatha Christie is my go-to. When I'm sick, that's what I read. I just reread my Hercule Poirot's and I know exactly what happens and I get slightly surprised every time.
That's right. Yeah, it is, isn't comforting. It? Even when you reread them. Oh, yeah. So that's it from us. But let us know what you're reading in isolation. We'd love to have some more to add to the list. Next week, I'll be back with The Wandering by Intan Paramedita, translated by Stephen J. Epstein. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go or email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And I'm on Twitter, Litzy, and Instagram at A. Bailey Karras. And Annie?
I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Litzy at Mr. _Annie.
Great. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye.